My next guest grew up in one of the wealthiest families in the United States. According to Business Insider, his personal inherited net worth in 2011 was in excess of $600 million. Yet what makes him a fascinating subject is that he has produced two well-regarded documentaries about the world in which he grew up. His first, Born Rich, was nominated for two Emmy Awards. His second film, finished in 2006, speaks to the challenges America faces as a society in which 1% of the people control nearly half the total wealth. My guest is Jamie Johnson, the great-grandson of the co-founder of Johnson & Johnson. Hi, Jamie. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
So tell us about the point of view of the film and its original purpose.
The two films I've made really were both intended to look at wealth and affluent families in the United States in a way that no one had done before in a documentary film. And wealth is a topic that is often considered uncomfortable and is something people have a difficult time discussing publicly and sometimes even privately within their own families and among personal friends. And I thought, well, let's bring this topic to the surface and let's explore the subject in a documentary film. There are all kinds of difficult issues surrounding wealth and issues of inequality and things like that, and the films focus on many of those issues.
So the wealthy, and I would say we're really not talking about the 1%, because, you know, a successful physician can easily be in the 1%. We're really talking about the ultra high rich now, really the 0.1%. Would that be more accurate in your view?
Yes, that's certainly true.
Okay. Those individuals as a group, and you were brought up in that culture, they find it difficult to talk about money amongst themselves as well? And also, what about interfamily?
I would say that families traditionally who have had wealth for multiple generations really do not like discussing money. It's something that's considered in bad taste. It's considered taboo. And I think that there's a long tradition of people being brought up in affluent circles, and they're taught from an early age that it's something you shouldn't discuss.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens then is many issues surrounding wealth, many times practical issues relating to investments and business-related issues, also personal issues surrounding wealth, wealth transference in wealthy families. Because the topic isn't discussed, many people don't succeed in affluent families on either of those fronts, even though they're raised in privileged environments and have great educations and have access to capital to invest. It's difficult often for them to find a way to be successful in business, and it's also difficult for them to find a way to be successful in their personal lives relating to issues surrounding money and how it's distributed and just handled and thought of within the family.
You know, there was a talk you gave, I believe it was on YouTube, and it was for The Moth, and you were talking about attending almost like a counseling session for the very wealthy. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that? I thought it was pretty funny.
Yes, there are different groups that are support groups for affluent individuals. And you see more and more of this because as the world becomes more aware of socially conscious investing and socially responsible stewardship of wealth, which is gaining popularity in affluent circles, and there's a greater awareness around that topic, you have these groups being formed by young wealthy people. And the requirement to join the group and membership is often that you are affluent and you do come from money. And people talk about some of the benefits and some of the excess baggage that goes along with inherited money. Of course, when they're talking about what they feel some of the excess baggage is and what they feel the drawbacks of being rich really are like, it can often become kind of laughable, and it's easy not to have sympathy, obviously, for people who have many privileges and sometimes want to complain about that.
Your father was, I think, noticeably torn in the video. You made multiple attempts to talk about openly with money, I think in a very kind of just casual way. And at the end of the video, at the end of the documentary, he's like, okay, let's talk about it. But he, you know, he kept, you know, self-stifling his responses and eventually just wasn't able to do it. And also what is ironic about that is that when he was, I think, around your age, he funded a film in the 1960s looking at the poor in South Africa. And your mom says towards the end of the film that he changed, you know, his kind of his personality or his way of thinking changed after he received a lot of peer pressure from within the family. So obviously he's your dad, and you know, that seemed kind of like an awkward moment. What's your take on the way he was handling, you know, you making this movie and the way he thinks about the money as well?
My dad is a really private guy. So anything that comes up, any personal topic with him, he's often reluctant to discuss. And he was raised and taught from a young age not to discuss money. And I think that he often tried to instill that value within our own nuclear family. So when I said I'm making a documentary film and it involves children of inherited wealth and these topics are going to come up and it may be in the media, he had a negative reaction and he didn't want to participate and he discouraged me to do that. And we conflicted in many ways, as you said, and that's something that you see play out over the course of both films that I made. I think on one level, he's traditional, he's kind of old school that way. So he feels that the films I made probably shouldn't have been made and these topics didn't need to be discussed and presented so publicly. And then on another side, he's a kind man and he is a loving man. And I think on a personal level, he supports me emotionally anyway in that he's pleased that I'm making films and that it's meaningful to me. And he sees that I want to do it. There's a conflict for him, of course, because he doesn't believe that it should be a public topic.
Right. Yeah, that definitely came across in the documentary and made it that much more interesting, that much more real. You interviewed about 28 people, so I counted on IMDb. Only really three of them were individuals who had created their own wealth. The rest were former government officials, the financial advisors to the Johnson family, and the heirs themselves. Why so few of the people who kind of originated their wealth, as opposed to those that just kind of comment on the effects of the wealth and those who were the beneficiaries of the wealth?
I think I had less access to people who were self-made. So many of the people I know through the network of associations I have naturally come from multi-generational wealth. And I tend to know less people in my own life who are self-made. Also, because I understand through experience and through close observation the experiences of people who have inherited wealth and how multi-generational wealth affects individuals and its effect on society and culture, that's something that I really have a special understanding of. And so I tend to focus on that angle as opposed to entrepreneurs and first-generation wealth creators. It's something that interests me. And in the film, I interview a guy named Paul Orfalea, who started the Kinko's Copy Center.
Right.
And he sold that, and he's a very successful guy and an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And he was a pleasure to get to know. He's very forthright, and he's outspoken. And that's another thing that came up through my journey of making this film, is that you often see people who are self-made, and they have a little bit more confidence in speaking publicly about their money and their own success. One of the reasons why I think that occurs is because people who generate wealth, a lot of wealth in a short period of time, have a greater sense that they could do it again, and they have greater self-belief that they can earn money. And so they don't feel as defensive when people ask them about their personal wealth and their affluence. They feel that it's easy for them to say, I earned it, and they have a feeling almost that they could do it again.
Right.
That's not always the case.
You bring up this point that, you know, those who inherit the wealth seem to feel less confident about it and less sanguine about the trappings of wealth, and are, you know, there's this unease. As a matter of fact, two interviews, one interested me especially, was with Nicole Buffett, Warren Buffett's granddaughter. And, you know, I follow Warren Buffett a lot, as I'm an investment advisor myself, and you know, I know the kind of culture that he permeates, but I was very surprised to hear that after the interview, in which it seemed like she was just being very simple and very honest and finding her way in the world, unless I missed something totally, the fact that he basically wrote her a very terse letter disinheriting her as a member of the family. Did that come as a shock to you? Was there anything in the documentary, maybe that did not actually end up in the documentary, that would have explained that situation more fully?
there really wasn't anything that would have merited his reaction. He had a very strong reaction, and I think it surprised everyone, especially Nicole, who was in the film, and you described that she received that letter from her grandfather. I think it just speaks to this strong sense that people who are very influential and have a great deal of money and who don't want it discussed and who don't want personal things about their own lives revealed publicly, they react and they go out of their way to try and control the flow of information. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there are consequences for younger members of affluent families who step out of line, so to speak, and then they're punished. In this case, that came in pretty harsh form.
I'm speaking with Jamie Johnson. He is the great-grandson of the co-founder of Johnson & Johnson, and he has made two films to date, and we're going to ask him what his new project is in a moment. The film I'm speaking about is One Percenters, right? That's the correct name?
The One Percent.
The One Percent, thank you. And I saw it on Netflix, and it's available on YouTube. Now, you know, it definitely seemed to me that the film had a point of view, and it was kind of, I don't want to say negative towards the wealthy, but more, I think, empathetic to the disparity between the wealthy and the rest of the country. As a matter of fact, you show a graph there that says that the average person of great wealth makes $1 million a year, and that's the average, whereas the average American makes $35,000 a year. Of course, that was in 06, so I'm sure the disparity is even greater today. And you spoke with the Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman, who's no longer with us, and he kind of got angry at you and stopped the interview, but he maintained that the wealth that these people created actually brings up the whole society. And as a matter of fact, Forbes stated in an article that the poorest in America are better off than 70% of the world, and that while it's true that there's more inequality in the U.S., it's not because the poor are poorer, it's because the rich are richer. Can I have some comment on that?
Yes, a number of things. One thing that happened is that when I started making the 1%, and even when the film was released, it was just before the financial crisis. So the film does have a point of view, and it does suggest that there are problems with the growing wealth gap, with the concentration of wealth at the highest tiers of the economic ladder, and potentially some of the problems that cause in terms of isolating different groups of people and a lack of general cohesion in culture and society. And when I was making this film, I felt that I was starting to see trends, and I was starting to notice that there was a sense of disconnection for the most affluent people in the country and the rest of the country and working people. And it wasn't as popular of a topic. It wasn't something that everyone was willing to accept, that there are problems in that inequality and there are problems with this sense of two Americas, some people have referred to it. But after, of course, the financial crisis, it's more widely accepted that there was a sense among the elite and at the top of financial institutions where people were making decisions that were reckless and that were not considering how their investments and their short-term financial goals and wealth building was potentially putting other people at risk. Now that's more widely accepted. Milton Friedman, who you mentioned, who I interviewed in the film, was one of the last interviews he ever did on video. Mm-hmm. He was infuriated with many of the questions that I put to him and my point of view. And he really maintains the strong belief that market forces would resolve all social and cultural problems, and that we realized during the financial crisis that that wasn't exactly true. Before the financial crisis, people were really more on board with Friedman's thesis. And of course, afterwards, they were saying, no, we have to reevaluate the sense that the free market is the solution for everything, and that maybe we do need regulation and we do need oversight in certain areas. So that's a long-winded response, but it is a complicated and involved answer. And you wonder, do these things come in cycles? I'm sure they'll, depending on where the economy is and what's happened, it will become fashionable again to say, hey, let's let the free market decide everything and let's let the wealthiest investors deregulate the economy and Wall Street. and let's all ride the wave. And of course, you know, that might backfire again as well.
I think you've made the point that it is complicated. There are no easy solutions. There's any number of ways to look at this thing. And a lot of it will depend upon, you know, how much the economy improves and how the rest of society fares. So, Jamie, we only have a few seconds left. Tell us what you're currently working on.
I'm working on fictional projects these days. I recently shot a short film called Adrift, starring Cornelia Livingston and Michaela Burnett. They're two very talented actors. And, you know, I've always been interested in personal relationships, the psychology of personal relationships, which come up in my documentaries. This fictional work is not about wealth, but it's about close relationships, how people manage them, and essentially it looks at how people can become more honest with themselves in psychological ways and work towards healthier and more functional relationships.
Well, honesty seems to be a theme of your life, perhaps. That seems to be the thread running through much of this. Jamie, thank you so much for joining us, and look forward to seeing that movie and having you back on when you're doing your next project. Thank you so much.
Thank you.